question about qualities that make a great leader. I talked about the big five personality traits and that leaders can be made, not just born, but it's a little bit of both. We talked about finasteride or propecia and how it's actually not harmful for testosterone, but it is harmful for DHT, the other important androgenic male hormone, and why I'm not a fan of it. We had a question about monogamy versus polyamory and how even though our tendencies may be to be polyamorous, we can choose to be monogamous if it's important enough for us to maintain a long-term viable, stable relationship. And then we finally also talked about side hustles and how they're a great way of starting a bootstrap company if you don't have the benefit of venture backing or as an alternative means of fulfilling other values. If your primary job is giving you financial stability. Welcome to Maximus Colin Radio Show, episode 32. This is our weekly show, Thursdays at 6 o'clock Pacific, where we talk about maximizing your mind, body, masculinity, and testosterone. So if you have any questions about optimizing your health, your hormones, or even your relationships, I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and while I'm not providing psychological or medical advice on this show, I'm happy to help you think through and coach you through whatever questions that you have. So we like to do a Q&A format. I always prioritize members of our Alpha Squad on our Discord and any folks that are willing to ask live questions. We have a bunch that were submitted in advance, but if you have any, feel free to speak up and ask them so I can talk it through with you, which is always more fun. We always start every show with a weekly unpopular opinion, as I like to share on Twitter. So this week's unpopular opinion is that social media is more harmful than helpful. I just recorded a podcast with Dylan Bennion, who is the CEO of MindBloom, is a fellow telemedicine company. They prescribe ketamine as a form of psychedelic psychotherapy. And it was really fascinating for someone who grew up and works in tech. He was actually talking about, and he actually worked at a social media company before his current company, that he basically uses an old Android phone. It's literally black and white, so he has no colors, and he has no social media. He doesn't even check his work email on his phone, and he does that very intentfully and mindfully because he knows how harmful it is. And so his quote was, to quote the great Notorious B.I.G., I know better than to get high on my own supply. And that's a common refrain that you'll hear, maybe not in Biggie's words, but amongst people in the tech community, the engineers and designers who often are at Facebook or other social media companies are the least likely to ironically either use it themselves or especially allow their children to use it, right? Steve Jobs and other tech entrepreneurs are notorious about like not letting their children overuse the very technology with which they created. So if the folks who are, you would argue, most knowledgeable about social media are reluctant to overuse it themselves and especially on their children because they're worried about the effects that it has on our brain, I think that does make us, should make us cautious about what it's doing to ours. So that's the first data point. Second data point is if you look at the clinical literature on social media, I think it's quite honestly mixed. And I think that should be fair and important to say. I don't think there's conclusive, overwhelming evidence that social media is harmful to mental health. And I want to be clear about that. This is my personal opinion. And I'll tell you why I find clinically, so this contrasts the research, clinically, I do not find that to be the case. Now, I particularly work with Silicon Valley CEOs and VCs. So this is not a normal or representative sample of the human population, but they're folks like Dylan. And most of those folks are not as stringent or restrictive as Dylan is. They live on their phones. They use it all the time. In fact, a lot of people do their work primarily nowadays on phones. I believe Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter and Square, literally doesn't have a laptop at home and he literally works off of his phone, which is quite remarkable. So what I find in my clinical practice working with these folks is that behavioral addictions are essentially the new drug addictions. So I'm seeing less and less substance abuse, although that still is common in terms of, drugs, alcohol, et cetera. And I'm seeing more and more sort of behavioral addictions. But to me as a psychologist, it doesn't matter if you're taking an exogenous substance, meaning a substance from outside of your body, or you're using a device to stimulate an endogenous or inside the body response in terms of stimulating dopamine, the net effect is very similar. Now, there is one concrete difference in the sense that certain exogenous drugs do cause physiological dependence, right? So meaning that when you withdraw from them, you have negative side effects, like a heroin withdrawal is notorious in terms of having really bad side effects. If you withdraw from benzodiazepines or alcohol or other GABA agonists, you can literally have a seizure, right? So you don't discontinue cold turkey, so to speak. There's not a lot of evidence that behavioral addictions necessarily have the same physiological withdrawal. So some people, as a result, question whether they're addictions. I think that's a poor argument to argue that they're not addictions, because people do experience cravings. Now, they may not have physiological withdrawal, but I do argue they have almost like a psychological withdrawal. There's almost this phantom phone syndrome. When people used to use vibration, for instance, as a way of alerting their notifications or text messages, you know, your phone would vibrate in your pocket. And when you didn't have your phone there, the brain was so used to that conditioned response that they would have this, they would literally think their pockets vibrating even when there was no phone there, right? And so I do think there is this psychological conditioning that happens, and you can have what is akin to a psychological withdrawal or craving that comes from excess social media and phone use. So I think that's an important thing to note. And in addition to that, if you think about the function that both drugs and behavioral addictions are serving, they're essentially avoidance behaviors, right? We use them in order to avoid negative feelings, usually when we're lonely, angry, tired, bored, stressed, or anxious. And we've developed that as a coping, maladaptive coping mechanism, that anytime we feel these negative emotions, our impulse, right? We impulsively reach for our phone, our social media, in order to distract ourselves and avoid those negative feelings. And so that becomes a coping mechanism that we overdo. That's why social media is so addictive. It induces a state of hyperfocus, which it very easily numbs negative thoughts and feelings. The problem, of course, is that as soon as you stop using it, the negative thoughts and feelings come right back. And I would argue they actually come back stronger, because every time you avoid a negative thought or feeling, especially negative emotions, it exacerbates it. Like, you build anxiety, like you build a muscle, in a negative way though this time. So that's why I literally say the number one rule of psychology is never ever avoid, never ever delay. And this is the problem with procrastination. A little task that may only take a few minutes of effort, if it's anxiety inducing, or if it's just quite frankly boring to do and there's a little bit of distress involved in it, the more you avoid it or put it off, the anxiety will build and build and build over time. And so the more, ironically, we use social media, that it does temporarily numb, distract our anxiety, but you're exacerbating it over time. And so it's actually exacerbating the problem. Now, there is some research that corroborates my clinical observation. And that's from a study that I often cite, which essentially validates the practice of dopamine fasting that I came up with, in which they took college students, they randomized two groups of them into use Facebook as you normally do, and the other group, randomly assigned, was told to essentially fast from Facebook. What they found was they reduced their use of Facebook by, I believe it was like 1.9 hours a day. So these folks were almost using Facebook 2 hours a day, right? And so over the span of a week, they saved 13.3 hours of time. So all this time, and this is, by the way, people say, I don't have time, I'm too busy. The reality is, if you're mostly like a modern citizen, you're wasting a tremendous amount of time, or any free time that you have is essentially sucked up by the social media machine, right? And so it creates this illusion of busyness, of that you don't have time. And you're right, because you're spending every spare moment on social media. So they found they had 13.3 hours of extra time. And then what did they do unprompted? They naturally started to engage in health behaviors. They're like, I'm going to cook more, I'm going to exercise more, I'm going to socialize more. The researchers, the experimenters didn't tell them to do this. They're just like, well, what am I going to do with all this free time that I've now found? I'm going to engage in healthier behaviors. In addition to that, they found a reduction in depressive symptomatology. So there was an improvement in their mood from reducing their social media use. So I think the lesson there is that dopamine fasting does work. It may have some mood improving benefits. And more importantly, it has time improving benefits. So if in my opinion, time is the most valuable thing in the world. And if something is going to get you back your time, that's the most valuable thing in the world. So if you aren't aware of this and you use an iPhone, you should absolutely use the screen time function. It literally tracks how much time you're using on your phone. And in fact, in our program, our Maximus program, we use it as one of the metrics that we're tracking. So you track how much sleep you get, how much you weigh as almost like the output of your nutrition, how much you're exercising. And then in terms of focus, a really nice objective measure of focus, I would argue, is not just what you're focusing on, but what you're not focusing on. And essentially screen time on your phone, unless you're working on your phone, although I would argue you shouldn't do that, contrary to Jack Dorsey. It's almost the inverse. The more obviously time that you're spending on your phone on screen time, the less time you're actually probably working or doing anything productive in real life. So it's almost the lack of focus is screen time, and you can use it as an objective sort of metric. So long story short, the way that I encourage people to think about social media, not that it's inherently evil, I'm obviously on social media right now, is you should think about social media as a drug. Social media is absolutely a drug, especially in terms of the neurological effects that it's having, minus the withdrawal symptoms, the physiological withdrawal systems, as we talked about. Now, drugs aren't bad. I'm not chemophobic or anti-pharma. Obviously, Maximus includes pharmaceutical drugs. But the philosophy that we generally, most responsible clinicians have, is you always provide the minimal effective dose, right, in order to get the treatment response. You're not trying to inundate people, you know, I don't think, for instance, anabolic steroid levels or bodybuilder levels of TRT to get people into their total testosterone to the 3,000 to 5,000 range, it's more is not better. There's downsides to that. Even though you're going to put on a huge amount of muscle mass and look like a bodybuilder, it's not great for your overall health or longevity if you look at how a lot of these bodybuilders turn out. I think rather than that, you're trying to get people to a high normal range, but something that's human and achievable by, let's say, a very fit and healthy athlete. Similarly, with social media use, you want to take the minimal viable dosage if you think about it as a drug. So I would argue there's actually a hormetic effect with social media. Hormesis, if you're not familiar with the term, is that even things that are toxic in maybe very, very low dosages are actually therapeutic or beneficial. And I would argue social media is the same way. I don't know exactly what the hormetic dosage. My hypothesis is that it's about 15 to maximum 30 minutes a day. That's just about the amount of time that you can use social media a day. You'll get some benefit from it if you use it responsibly. But anything more than 15 to 30 minutes, it's probably negatively affecting your brain. And more importantly, it's negatively affecting your time and your behavior because of the opportunity cost of what you're giving up. So I don't believe in abstinence-only models when it comes to social media use and technology, because we can't escape it. Everyone, for our social networks and keeping up with friends and family, it's really hard to not be on any networks. If you are very stringent, God bless you. Maybe you don't need to be on any social media, but I don't think that's going to work for the majority of people going forward. So rather than being abstinent, like telling people don't drink at all, which I also generally think that doesn't work for most people, telling people to minimize their drinking, minimize their social media use to the hormetic levels is probably a better approach. So it's harm reduction if you think about it. So 15 to 30 minutes a day is probably what you should limit and dopamine fast to. If you're interested, you can check out if you just type in my name, Dopamine Fasting Medium, it's called Dopamine Fasting 2.0, which is an evidence-based protocol for how to do this. Now, how do you spend that 15 to 30 minutes? There's an old saying that says you are the average of the 5 people that you spend the most time with. I think that's kind of true in real life. There's in fact studies that show that obesity is literally contagious. If your 5 friends are obese, you're much more likely to be obese than if your friends are normal weight. And that's because you probably hang out together, you eat together, and also you create social norms together. Where if you're the fat friend, unfortunately speaking, out of your 4 friends, you're gonna feel social pressure to be like, I feel like the odd one out. I want to catch up. But if it's everyone's obese, it becomes sort of the new normal within your social circle. I think that same principle actually applies online, which is I think you are the average of the 5 influencers that you follow the most on social media. So I would actually encourage people to be to curate essentially the people that they follow, because you should think about influencers. Essentially, those are your role models. In fact, they're almost like the family that you choose. Jordan Peterson maybe is like the wise father figure that you wish you had. I try to embody sort of a brother figure or archetype in terms of what I put out there. And whatever your needs are that you're trying to get met by following someone, you should think about an influencer as someone who's putting you under the influence, right? And under the influence is meaning like alcohol or drugs. And like I said, social media is a drug. So you want to be very careful about how much you consume and also the quality, right? Are you going to be drinking some bootleg moonshine that was produced that's probably toxic? No, that's a shitty way of consuming alcohol. If you're going to consume alcohol, at least have some good stuff, maybe some high quality red wine or something that it's worth the damage, essentially, right? So I think it's the same thing with social media. You know that it's probably damaging in any more than 15 to 30 minutes a day. So be very picky about who you follow. It should be someone who's uplifting, inspirational, a good role model. Would you want them to like be your god, you know, parent, or you know, like take care of your kids, or be, or if their kids were watching them, are they a good role model for them? I think that's your useful heuristics, your rules of thumb. Do you feel like you learn a lot from them, or are they just repeating stale you know, messages over and over again that you agree with, but you're not like learning or growing or being challenged by that person? By the way, this is a huge phenomenon I see on Twitter. There's a lot of like bodybuilding fitness folks that have kind of hacked the algorithm. They know exactly what to say to get a lot of retweets and likes, but it's nothing interesting or novel. They're just like, oh, you know what? Like, don't eat carbs, go lift weights. You know what the best therapy is? Hitting the gym. And they're like these sayings that like most people like and agree with if you're inclined towards that direction. But are you actually learning or getting anything new other than liking and validating your own beliefs? Not really, right? You should have people that push you to be thought-provoking. And that's why I literally start out every single one of these weekly radio shows with a weekly unpopular opinion, because I like to push the boundaries of convention. I like to push kind of contrarian thinking that I obviously think is true, not to be contrarian for contrarian's sake. But unfortunately, I think a lot of wisdom is paradoxical, right? And even though everyone is kind of pushing the narrative that, you know, social media is normative, that you're a weirdo if you're not on it, and it helps you feel more connected, right? Facebook's literally motto or adage in the world is, you know, we help the world be more connected. I don't think they're actually doing that. I think they're giving the illusion of connection. And so the reality is, I think we're even more disconnected and lonely, objectively speaking, than we've ever felt before. So as Prince famously said, I have a great video of Prince accepting a sort of award at a tech show. He was saying, you know, the internet's not a bad thing. And this is back in the 90s. I think he saw this coming. You know, use technology, but don't let it use you, right? That's such a great line. Use technology, but don't let it use you. I think that's my same philosophy with social media. We use social media obviously to get our message out there, because I think, you know, we put out our brand that masculinity is a good, positive and healing force in the world, that testosterone does matter to your health and functioning as a man, and other really important messages that we put out there. And so we use social media. But another helpful rule of thumb is you want to produce as much on social media as you consume, in my opinion, right? So if you're all just like, you know, needlessly scrolling, you never post anything, then maybe you want to change the way that you're utilizing it. Now, here's an interesting rule of thumb. Maybe you feel like I don't have a lot to contribute. Maybe I don't want to be posting all the time. That's fair. But if you're trying to think about it as almost like a one-to-one ratio, what that means is, fine, if you don't want to post a lot or produce a lot, that's great. But that means you have to cut down your consumption too, right? In order to balance the two. So the onus of responsibility comes on you. So if you think about it, it's very easy to passively consume, right? Like Netflix is the best example. You just turn it on and it autoplays, and you can literally spend all day, every day, just being a passive consumer of Netflix. It takes zero effort, and it's so stimulating that imagine trying to pay attention in a classroom for 12 hours. You can never do that. But you can absolutely watch your favorite series on Netflix for 12 hours straight. People binge watch Netflix all the time. So passive consumption is so easy, it's so addictive, it's such a stimulating drug that there's no almost effort involved, right? And so production, however, is effortful. you have to sit there and be like, what am I going to write? What am I going to tweet? I got to take a picture. I got to take a video. I got to post it. It's effortful. And production is very, it's much more difficult for it to be addictive. Now, it still can be addictive. Obviously, influencers can be addicted to the validation that they get from producing and posting. That's its own problem. But it's a useful rule of thumb to try to make your consumption effortful and say, if I'm going to read one tweet for every tweet that I post, or I'm going to watch one video for every video that I post, it's either going to get you to post more, or in my opinion, because of inertia, it's going to get you to consume less, right? Which is like the goal. As I mentioned, you want to take the minimal effective dose, the hormetic dose, 15 to 30 minutes a day maximum, in order to reduce, quite frankly, the damage that's happening to yourself and your brain from social media use. Just like alcohol, like generally speaking, the newest guideline and recommendations, we talked about this in the last show, you shouldn't be consuming more than a drink a day. And even then, there's really no amount of alcohol that's safe. So I would argue it's the same for social media. You shouldn't be consuming more than 15 to 30 minutes of social media a day. And there's probably no amount that's safe, just almost like alcohol. But if you're going to consume it, really focus on high quality content. Follow the influencers, the five influencers that you think are the best role models, surrogate family members almost, that you care about. And obviously you can use it in other ways. Like if you're just using messaging to keep in touch with friends and family, that's fine. I think that's a little separate than social media use. That's just messaging and communication. I'm talking about the consumption of content and news feeds in particular. So anyway, that is my weekly unpopular opinion. Use technology, don't let it use you. And think about social media as a drug. And so not that drugs are bad, but you want to be very thoughtful and about your drug use in using the right drugs and the minimal dosages that get you the most benefit with the least amount of cost and side effects.
I wanted to get your thoughts on, what do you think makes a good leader? And do you think it's something that most people who love being good leaders are born with? Or can it be trained and developed as a skill?
Yeah, what a great question. What makes a great leader? And are they born or are they made? This is like a... It's like a classic kind of question that's brought up in leadership. I'll give you my opinion, my subjective opinion on this. First of all, I do think there are qualities that are innate that make someone a better leader. So as a psychologist, I utilize the Big Five personality. So if you're not familiar with that, it's the acronym is OCEAN. Openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. So let's talk about, from a psychological framework, what are the traits? And I'm sure there's research studies on this, and I'll look it up afterwards, but I'll tell you just my subjective opinion of what makes a good leader. So openness to experience is actually very important as a leader, especially if you're a leader of a company, because openness to experience, founders of companies, because I work with them as an executive psychologist, tend to be very high in openness to experience. And the reason is you need to like see the future, right? You need to have a vision for the future that's not there yet. And you believe you're going to make that into reality. So you need to have like a deep analysis of a market and a vision for why you think you can do it better. And so as a result of that, like imaginativeness, creativity, being in touch with your emotions, those are the sub facets of openness to experience. And I think that's actually very important. Second, conscientiousness. Conscientiousness is the best predictor of professional success in academic and your career. And I do think it's important as a leader to be particularly conscientious. Now, the caveat I will add to this, and I've talked about this in some of my writing, is the visionary type of leader. Like think about a Steve Jobs, right? They tend to be very high in openness to experience. They're not often very high in conscientiousness. There seems to be a little bit of a trade-off. There's rare people who are very high in openness and very high in conscientiousness. It's usually one or the other. And so if you are more of a high openness to experience / visionary founder, you really want to find a conscientious COO, chief operating officer, or chief of staff, or CTO. And Steve Jobs, who did he find? Steve Wozniak, who is the brilliant technical counterpart to him. And you'll see this a lot. It's like in a lot of great technology companies, it's these duos, right? It's like the genius visionary and the very conscientious builder, and they make a great dynamic duo. Extroversion, introversion, I don't think predicts success as much, but I'll tell you a little anecdote. You need to be somewhat charming or influential as a leader, right? Like, great leaders are often very inspirational. They're great salespeople. Whether or not they're literally doing sales, if you're obviously recruiting people, you're getting people to buy into your mission, and that is sales. And so I do think introverts can make great leaders, but they have to learn to become what I call pseudo extroverts. So Brian Little, who was my personality psychology professor, talked about this, and he explained this through an anecdote that he shared himself. So Brian, and I might have mentioned this in previous podcasts, had a perfect 5.0 out of 5.0 rating in the Harvard Q Guide, which is like the professor rating system. That's kind of like Rate My Professor. And charming professor, 500 people, oversubscribed class. Half the people weren't even psych majors because he was such a dynamic, amazing lecturer. And one day when he was talking about introversion, extroversion, he was like, I have a secret to tell you. I'm an extreme introvert. And everyone kind of like gasped. And they were like, what are you talking about? You're so funny and charming and witty and we love your class. You're not an introvert. And he's like, no, I realize that in order to be an effective teacher, and especially to get 500 people to pay attention to me instead of Facebook, as we were talking about, I have to be witty, charming, funny, and entertaining. And so he's like, I learned to be that in the pursuit of my personal goal and project to be effective. But I'm an introvert, and that doesn't change the essence and core of who I am. And in fact, out of the big five, I would argue introversion, extroversion is the most neurological or genetically based of the big five. So he's like, I would in fact get so overwhelmed after lecturing for an hour, I'd have to lock myself in the bathroom and I couldn't talk to anyone after class because that's how introverted I was. And he's like, I'm better now, but to this day, I still lock myself in my office and I can't have office hours for a few hours. I have to read or write and just have my quiet time in order to enter what he called my restorative niche, right? So he's like, introverts tend to burn out unless they go recharge their batteries and find a place, a restorative niche to do that. And that was his advice to us. He's like, you know, Harvard students score as slightly extroverted. And it's a conundrum because introverts are much better students, right? They can buckle down and study. So he's like, why are you the best students in the country, so to speak, slightly extroverted? He's like, you're not. You're faking it. Because the system, unlike other countries like India and China and Iran and Japan, where you have your college entrance is just based on the results of an exam, in the US it's holistic. Are you the captain of the track team? Are you the president of Key Club? Right? You have to exhibit leadership qualities. And so you learn to do that even though you're really introverted in order to bulk up your applications and get into Harvard. And he's like, you're going to be the future leaders of the world, but you have to you learn to be pseudo extroverted in order to be effective, but you have to find your restorative niche. So that's my message is to your question about, is it born or is it made? Extroverts probably make better leaders, but introverts can learn to be pseudo extroverted in order to be effective leaders, as long as they learn to recharge their batteries. Agreeableness. Agreeableness is a really interesting trait. Agreeableness is your ability to get along with other people. In the context of leadership and running a company, though, I believe it's actually better to be slightly disagreeable. And the reason is it's really hard. You have to make hard decisions, especially when it comes to people, including firing people. And it's very hard if you're an agreeable person to let someone go. But the reality of like high functioning companies, especially to avoid assholes, is you have to let people go and you have to make hard decisions. You also have to push people. A lot of people are intrinsically lazy. And so there's a lot of just personnel stuff that you have to do as a manager. And you have to be slightly disagreeable, I believe, in order to do it. And it's the same thing as extroverted. It's not that an agreeable person can't be a good leader, but they have to learn to be tough, right? In order to push people, fire people as necessary, and do the right things. So I think you have to learn to be disagreeable if you're not already. And the last trait is neuroticism. Neuroticism is your tendency to experience negative emotions. Now, if the other four factors are in place, there's in fact a lot of leaders that are quite neurotic. If you look around Silicon Valley, I would argue quite a lot of them. And so it's not a prerequisite that neuroticism is a gating factor. The problem is it can't be too high. If you're too neurotic, you're going to basically fall apart. And so the subfacet of neuroticism that I always look at when I do this work with clients is called vulnerability. Vulnerability is basically, do you fall apart under stress? So the other facets of neuroticism, right? Like how much anger, anxiety, or depression do you experience? They are important, But there are great people, like take the people who are bipolar, right? Kanye West, which is public information, is on the bipolar spectrum. And so his mood is all over the place, but he's a crazy billionaire genius and one of the greatest musical artists of our time. So obviously his experience to his tendency to experience negative emotions is worse than other people. But in some ways, maybe the mania has actually helped him. But I think the difference, though, and what has made Kanye successful is, except when he got too manic and they literally had to cancel concerts, you can't be so vulnerable that you're going to fall apart under stress. So it's okay to have negative emotions as long as it doesn't keep you from doing your work, right? Now, if you're neurotic, but you work really hard and you're not a procrastinator, then I think it's much more manageable. In addition to that, Kanye is actually a lot more conscientious than people give him credit for. And I know this because when he got really into his like spirituality and Christianity and faith, he tweeted a picture of the Bible, that he was studying the Bible. And this guy is like highlighting it in three different colors, right? Like, who does that? I know who does that. Highly conscientious people I went to Harvard with, right? Highlighting in three colors. He was studying it like he was studying for a physics exam, right? And so that tells me he had other traits that almost like mitigated the negative or adverse effects of neuroticism. So I think those are the personality traits that make good leaders. And I think it's somewhere in between being born and made. I think some people, quite frankly, have those. Personality is highly genetic. But I do think, as I mentioned, specifically with extroversion and agreeableness, it is modifiable in an environmental context, right? You're not going to change your underlying trait, but you can learn to act extroverted or disagreeable in order to achieve your goals in a particular context. And so I do think great leaders are born, but I think they can also be made if it's important enough for you in the pursuit of your personal projects.
Thank you, doctor. Especially the part about extroversion and introversion really seems interesting to me, since I myself think of myself more as an introvert that has trouble speaking in public or being in large gatherings of people for extended periods of time. And right. As you said, I need time for myself to reset. And I say to myself, how can I train to be a good leader if I get nervous when I have to face people?
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, developing a little bit of extroversion seems to be the solution.
Practice. So you know what? I do this as like a personal challenge for myself for fun. Back when I was dating more often, especially on a first date or when I first time I met someone, I would ask them, do you think I'm an introvert or an extrovert? And I would say 80% of the time, people would guess that I'm an extrovert because I would be social and talkative and hopefully charming in the context of a date at least. And guess what? They're very wrong. I'm an introvert. And it's the same thing. But I, like other Harvard students, learn to be pseudo extroverted because obviously if you want a date to go well, especially as a guy, probably have to do a little bit more of the work. You should be a little bit funny. You should be charming. You should have some liveliness and spirit to you, right? And I was hanging out with a friend the other day and I asked them this question just for fun. And they literally didn't believe me. They're like, no, you are not an introvert. You like to talk. You're so sociable, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, exactly. I learned to be, right? And it's not that I'm faking it. That's the important thing I want to emphasize. It's not inauthentic. I actually enjoy. And by the way, introverts do enjoy social company. The difference is like, does it drain your batteries or does it charge your batteries? So I love spending time with people. I enjoy doing these podcasts. It's fun and interesting conversation, but it does drain me. Like literally at the end of these, after an hour of being on this podcast, I always tell Victor, I go to the gym. I don't talk to anyone. I'm like, I want to be out of here. So yes, it's definitely possible. And I'm a shining example of it. I'm an introvert who seems very extroverted because I've learned to be because I care. That's the thing. You have to find something that it's worth draining your batteries for that makes it worthwhile. Because otherwise it's like, you know, why do something that's against your sort of temperament?
Awesome. Thank you very much. You gave me a lot to think about.
Absolutely.
This person just put in a comment. Sometimes I avoid to do eye contact. It makes me feel odd and uncomfortable.
Yeah, this is a good point. I actually struggle with this too. And I probably, if you guys watch me, I occasionally forget to do it. There's a lot of reasons for that. I think if you're on the autism spectrum, eye contact is not innately comfortable. It just may be something about the disorder that it's just, it's not innate. And I think you realize this when you hang out in Silicon Valley. A lot of people do not make eye contact with you because a lot of people are on the spectrum. That's one. Two, if you have social anxiety or social phobia, it's kind of intimidating to make eye contact with people because, you know, people are looking at you, right? And so that really is something that can be overcome with practice. The hard part is just recognizing that you're doing it. I don't think a lot of people are aware when they avoid eye contact until other people point it out to them. But if you kind of keep it in the back of your mind of this is something that I'm trying to practice, right? When I'm out with someone, I'm going to try to maintain eye contact. Now, don't be like weird about it and like stare unnecessarily. There is natural breaks in eye contact that happen. But you can, if you have someone who's friendly with you, right? Maybe you don't want to do this on a first date. But if you have a friend that you're safe with and say, hey, look, I'm trying to work on improving my eye contact. Can you tell me when I'm starting to be weird about it, right? Like if I'm looking away too often, I'm looking down and it's more than a momentary glance and it just seems, I don't know, strange to you, let me know. And if they do that, and it's going to be a little, maybe it's a little weird for them, but if they're your friend, you just be like, hey, look, for the next hour as we're hanging out, we're having dinner or drink, just point it out every single time so I can break this habit and just do me a favor on this. You'll get that immediate reinforcement. And then you can really break this as a habit. Now, like I said, just like with introversion, this may be draining to you. It may induce stress and anxiety to maintain eye contact. And so be aware that it's going to be tiring, maybe if you are socially anxious or on the autism spectrum, for you to, again, go against your sort of normal temperament. But there's two things that happen. One, it gets better over time. We know this with anxiety disorders, that the greater exposure that you do, you can extinguish sort of the anxious response. Maybe it won't go down to zero, but if you're avoiding eye contact a lot, when you do make eye contact, it may induce like an 8 out of 10 in terms of anxiety because you do it so infrequently. And then when you do it, maybe it's awkward. But if you really start practicing and you're doing it most of the time, maybe it'll go down to a 4, maybe it'll go down to a 3, and you can live with a 3 or 4 in terms of your anxiety. The second thing is just like the restorative niche thing that I talked about with introversion. It may be tiring, but at the end of it, stop socializing and go stare off into space or go stare into a computer and, you know, recharge your eye batteries, so to speak. And, you know, you'll feel normal again.
Is Propecia bad for a man's testosterone? If Propecia ruins testosterone, what are other hair restoration treatments that do not harm testosterone?
Yeah, this is a great question. So for those who are not familiar, Propecia is the brand name for a drug called finasteride. And Propecia, or aka finasteride, is a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. And that's just a fancy term for there's an enzyme that converts testosterone into DHT, or dihydrotestosterone. So if you block the conversion of testosterone to DHT, what happens? It actually slightly increases testosterone. So no, Propecia is not bad or does not ruin testosterone. In fact, it slightly increases it, not by a lot, right? So people don't use Propecia or finasteride as a testosterone boosting treatment. I don't know how much it increases. I'll have to go back and look at the literature. I'm guessing around, I don't know, 10%, 15%. So it's not adverse or harmful to testosterone. In fact, it's probably going to increase it just a little bit. What it is adverse or ruin is DHT. And it does so obviously by design, in the sense that your DHT, and this is the hormone that people are less familiar with, right? I kind of, this is an oversimplification, but I think about sort of testosterone. Testosterone is an anabolic and androgenic hormone. DHT is more androgenic. Androgenic is like the aggressive kind of part of masculinity. It's where, you know, like body hair, your beard growth, your deep voice, those all like oily skin, those all come from androgenic effects or side effects. It is like the masculinizing sort of hormone. So when you take Propecia or finasteride, your DHT levels plummet. Now, the reason that they do that is they believe that DHT is harmful to the scalp. And it interferes with the hair growth cycle and contributes to androgenic alopecia, also known as male pattern baldness. The problem, however, is it doesn't just block it at the level of the scalp. And even if you try the topical finasteride or Propecia, that Hims and happy head now sell. It's complete bullshit because it gets absorbed into the scalp and absorbed into your body. I've in fact tested this myself. I've taken 1 milligram of finasteride, which is a standard dosage, and my DHT levels went from the 50s down to like 10 or 12, right? Which is like sub-physiological. It's like below normal. When you use the topical form, I was like, oh, I don't want to do that to myself. Let's just use the topical form so it only goes on your scalp. And that's what they claim, right? Guess what happens when I did a blood test? Went down to exactly 10 or 12. So topical, oral, it all absorbs into your system. It plummets your DHT. But I think if you care about your masculinity and feeling good, you don't want sub-physiological DHT, right? It's literally what gives you your aggression and your drive. And so I don't think systemically reducing your DHT long-term is quite frankly a very good idea. And so that's why we're working on something that doesn't block 5-alpha reductase that's good for hair and beard growth. And we'll talk about that at another time. In the meantime, you can use minoxidil or Rogaine. That's over the counter. It's mildly effective. It is FDA approved for hair growth. It's not as effective as finasteride, but I think it's a lot safer. And so I do use minoxidil myself. You should obviously talk to your doctor about whether it's right for you.
Hey, Dr. Cam, longtime fan and podcast listener. I have a question which I'd love for you to cover on the next podcast. Your thoughts on monogamy versus polyamory. I never cheated, but always found it a bit difficult to commit to one person because there are so many beautiful women in the world. Several of my friends who are the most alpha are in some variations of an open relationship. However, I'm now with a girl who I feel 100% committed to. Perhaps for the first time ever, I have close to zero interest in anyone else, which is nice, but also makes me feel like I'm losing some aspect of being, quote, alpha. I always thought that it's quite natural for men to be attracted to several women.
Yeah, this is a long question. It has a couple different parts, so I think it's important to address all the different parts of it. So first of all, let's almost work our way backwards. The caller stated, I always thought it's quite natural for men to be attracted to several women. That is probably true, right? In the sense that I think men are attracted to beautiful women. There was a funny video that I posted on my Twitter the other day. This guy was kind of joking about like all the different million forms of sexuality that there is. And he's like, I'm a hot sexual. I'm only attracted to beautiful women and you can't discriminate against me for my sexuality. Obviously it's like it's a joke, but there's a hint of truth to what he's saying. If you look at the genetic reality of human evolution, there's a large percentage of males who essentially never mate and never produce offspring. I don't know what it is exactly. I'm guessing around 20%. And then there's obviously some men like Genghis Khan who are probably responsible for 20% of the Asian male population now, or the general Asian population in terms of being direct descendants of Genghis Khan, because he probably had hundreds of wives and God knows how many children. So it's never pure one-on-one monogamy has not been the historical norm. Now, what's happened, though, is it's very different to have like a feudal warlord society in which like a king or whoever is at the top of the social hierarchy essentially hoards all the women and has a harem and has social resources. That happens less than it ever has in human history. And as we have more democratic and egalitarian societies, essentially, I think, if you think about it, modern civilization is almost like a new social contract, which is saying instead of like one or the top few men essentially hoarding all the women and then the bottom few, the bottom whatever 20% essentially get nothing. The problem with those societies is that they're very unstable, right? Because if your literally biological purpose on Earth is to reproduce and 20% or one in five guys, it basically gets the short end of the stick, you're likely to like rebel and rise up and try to overthrow that government or that system because fuck it, your bloodline's going to die out with you. So why not, at least if there's any cause to go out for, it's probably that. So that's why those societies were often very brutal, right? And it has to be almost like an authoritarian warlord that can try to maintain that kind of hypergamous polyamorous kind of society. What we find is monogamous kind of based societies where the majority of men do have the opportunity to successfully mate if they wanted to. Guess what? They become a lot more peaceful and stable because you don't have one out of five men ready to like overthrow a government because they're not going to be able to mate. Now, that's essentially what it's evolved to. However, this is the interesting phenomenon. This is my personal thesis, is that dating apps have totally upended things and we're right back now to a hypergamous society. The difference is you don't need to be the leader of a nation state or a warlord in order to get all the women. All you have to do is be in the top 5 to 20% of men. I've mentioned this Twitter data before. The top 20% of men compete for the top 80% of women. And the bottom, 80% of men compete for the bottom 20% of women. It's very unfair. And in fact, women only swipe on 5% of the profiles that they see on Tinder, right? So I always tell guys, like, look, if you're not in the top 5%, top 5 to 20%, you shouldn't even bother doing online dating in terms of physical attractiveness, because you will literally not get swiped on, or you'll get swiped on people who are going to be, quite frankly, less attractive or less beneficial as a partner to you than what you can find in real life. So I think we're kind of back to a hypergamous, almost polyamorous society. And what's happening, and we know this with the statistics, there was a poll that was asked about, like, how many people have had sex in the last year? It hasn't changed that much for women, but it has decreased for men, right? I think like 20% of men have not had sex in the last year who are under the age of 30, I think, if I'm getting it right. So obviously, if you kind of put two and two together, you're like, well, it's not happening for women, but it is happening for men. What's going on there? It just means that we're going back to a state where, if you want to use the term alpha, males are sleeping with more women, right? That 5% that's getting swiped on Tinder is definitely sleeping with more than one woman. He's probably sleeping with like five women, right? So that guy, we don't need 100% of men. Like, there's not a one-to-one ratio, right? So if you think about it, like, if 5% of men are even sleeping, let's say, with 20 women, right? For every 100 women, you only need like five guys, assuming I did that math correctly. And that's kind of the state of society today. At least in terms of like online dating, I would say. So that all that being said, that's kind of the natural tendency of what tends to happen. And so I'm not surprised when you say several of my friends who are the most alpha are in some variations of open relationships. Now, I'm kind of curious if that's truly open or not, meaning there's a lot of societies. You look at like traditional Italian culture when I was traveling there. Even like I would argue Chinese and Hong Kong elite society, people have mistresses. Now it's not truly open in the sense that they have a wife and their wife would not condone them in terms of cheating. They probably suspect that they're cheating, but it's almost like a don't ask, don't tell policy in the sense that they're like, look, as long as you don't rub it in my face, you're focusing on your family, you're providing for them. If you go and have some, dalliances, that's up to you, but just don't rub it in my face, don't make me jealous, and don't leave your family, and don't leave your children. So it's almost like a begrudging tolerance that a lot of women will do because they love their husbands, and they don't want to give up on them. And so if you listen to folks like Kevin Samuels on Instagram, he talks about this. He's like, if you're a high-value man, he's like, you're likely to have multiple options and you're likely to exercise them. And so women are often unrealistic in expecting a man to be, quite frankly, monogamous or faithful if they're very, very high value, because essentially a man is only as faithful as the number of options that he has. Now, I think Kevin may be a little bit cynical. I don't fully agree with that. I do think that even if you're a high value man, whether you want to not, you want to use the term alpha, you can choose to be monogamous, regardless of whether it's your nature, right? Like, well, I do think we're far enough evolved as human beings that we're not just biologically deterministic. So even if it's not the, like I said, we talked about the whole history of it, the natural state of things, if you are 100% committed to your partner, and that's what you said, you really love this person, and you have not made that arrangement. Now, if you and your partner make a choice to have an open relationship, I believe in honesty about it. Like, if you want to do that, communicate that with them and see if they're open to it. And if they are, then, you know, God bless you. I don't think there's just one way to have a relationship if it honestly works for you. However, I will tell you this. There was a documentary that I saw on polyamory. And they interviewed a psychologist and they said something really interesting. They said, you know, polyamory has been around a long time and it never sort of works and is not sustainable for a very simple reason. And that's human beings get jealous, right? And that's why the model that I shared with you tends to work better, ironically. This kind of like keep it under the table. I probably know about it, but I'm not going to ask. And then you're not going to rub in my face works because the moment that the wife knows you have a mistress and knows who she is and that she's younger and more attractive than she is, the jealousy sets in and it's probably not going to be tolerable or sustainable. Right? I almost feel like it has to be you either have to do that model or you have to be a complete extreme open model where it's completely out in the open and the person for whatever reason is just like not a typical human being and not very jealous about it. But it's really hard in reality to sustain. So I actually think monogamy is more likely the ideal state for modern evolved men. And especially if you want to maintain a long-term committed relationship. So yeah, like you're always going to want to be attracted to maybe beautiful women, other women than your primary partner. That's fine. But that's your responsibility and choice or whether you act on it. Just because you have the desire doesn't mean you need to act on it, right? So you don't have to punish yourself or feel guilty or shameful for your drive or your tendency. You're a man, and you know, men probably tried to spread their seed far and wide biologically. But if you're like, you know, I'm speaking from a values perspective now, I'm speaking with my prefrontal cortex, higher order leadership self, you're like, you know what, I really want to maintain a long-term relationship with this woman, have a stable family situation, and I want this to work long-term, I'm going to not exercise that drive and choose to be faithful against my drive. And I think men and human beings' capacity to override biological drives based on psychology, based on values like sacrifice and honor and loyalty and commitment is what makes human being noble and above the savagery of animals. So yes, don't feel guilty for wanting more, but it is your choice. And I think it's a beautiful choice if you choose to be monogamous.
Could you give out any advice on a side hustle or a way to make extra income on the weekends? I know it's a little off topic to ask, but I also figured since you advise people with startups, maybe you would know about some good ways to earn some extra money or things to do to get started. I just want to hurry and quit my job, so I'm feeling like if I have a certain amount of money, I could quit, pursue something I am actually interested in, even if it meant taking a job with lower pay. As long as I didn't work as many hours as I am now, and I want to do something creative full-time, graphic design, writing, whatever, as long as it's meaningful.
It's what's the purpose of the side hustle that you're doing? I think we're in a very interesting generation, right? If you look at the traditional model of employment, you used to work for one company for 25 years, same company, you get a gold watch at the end of it and a pension or retirement, and they treated you like family because you almost were. That model outside of like, I don't know, the federal government is basically gone, right? Pensions are for gone. And most people stick around for a company. I think the average, at least Silicon Valley engineer, sticks around for 18 months. And the reason is because they're incentivized to like quit, jump, and get promoted and get higher pay, at least as an engineer. So those days are long gone. And so I think what's happened is this is the era of the side hustle. People are doing multiple things at once. And I think it's good and bad. And I'll talk about, you know, models that I think are good. In your particular case, it sounds like you're not feeling fully fulfilled or utilized at your current job. Sounds like you want to do something you're actually interested in, as you said, that's more creative, right? You mentioned graphic design, writing, etc. So I actually think for most people, unless you have like a nest egg or other external financial support, it's not a good idea to quit the job, even if you don't like it, and then go pursue something that's brand new, unless you're absolutely sure. I'm sure this applies for 5% of people. Like some people just need to quit, drop out, like Elon Musk quit the first semester of grad school at Stanford and slept on the, you know, on the floor of some building and took showers at the YMCA. Elon Musk is not a normal human being, right? I don't think that's a great idea that you don't make enough money that you need to go to a YMCA or a gym to take a shower. That's probably going to create more stress than most people can tolerate. Elon can tolerate a lot of stress. He's literally still sleeping on the Tesla factory floor, at least as of a few years ago. So man is built different, as they say. For most people, though, the smarter thing to do is you should start the thing that you want to do as a side hustle. Do it on the nights and weekends. So particularly if you're trying to start a company, I see this a lot with like folks who are maybe working at a bigger company where it's more 9 to 5, 9 to 6, 9 to 7. You have enough time, maybe if you don't have kids, to start something on the nights and weekends. Now, it may sacrifice all your other interests or hobbies, right? I wouldn't recommend sacrificing your sleep or your health for it, but you're going to be like, look, I want to become a graphic designer. I want to become a writer. So I'm going to spend my nights and weekends doing it. And you build it up on the side until you achieve the financial means to quit your full-time job. It's a lot less stressful to do that. I see that with colleagues in my field, right? It takes about 2 years to build a full-time private practice as a psychologist, right? And so if you try to do that from scratch, you're going to not be in a great financial situation, you know, seeing one patient and then five patients, you know, until you build it up. It's much easier to get a full-time job working for someplace. They're not going to pay you as much as a full-time private practice, but you can start seeing your patients on nights and weekends. And in fact, it's more beneficial because patients love when you see them on nights and weekends. My private practice is on Sunday, right? I'm one of the few people who works on the weekend, until you can build up your practice. And then you can quit and you're not going to take a salary hit. You're going to have less stress about it. Now, in the interim, it's stressful because now you have a full-time job and a part-time job. But I think long-term, it's less stressful because you transition a lot smoother. And second, you also find out if it's viable. You don't quit until it's working. I see a lot of people quit. They try to do their own company and then it fails miserably. And then they're like, now I'm a year or two out. I've lost income. And now I got to, you know, why did I quit this cushy gig or give up all these great benefits? And it didn't work out. So I do think it's often a safer path to do it as a side hustle. Now, the one exception, though, I think venture funding has changed the name of the game in terms of risk tolerance, because if you quit and you get funding, you're essentially bankrolled, right? Like, you know, we raised $5 million to start Maximus. And so we can pay everyone actually good fair market salaries even before our company was making money. So for the first year, our company did not make any money, right? Because we were building the infrastructure for it. We're making money now. And even then, we still have to make more money than we're burning, right? But venture funding allows you to do that. And so if you're bootstrapping, I would say the side hustle until it's viable is a smarter way of going about it. If you're fortunate enough to be able to get venture funding, you're much more likely to quit because essentially someone is externally bankrolling you, you know, and making it more possible for you to take on that risk. So that's kind of my philosophy. What I don't like in terms of side hustles is a lot of people who are piecing together multiple side hustles in order to make it work. There are some people who they just love doing multiple sort of things. You could argue I'm almost an example. I technically have three jobs. I'm the full-time CEO of a telemedicine company. I teach 1 hour a week as a clinical professor of psychiatry. And then I have a private practice on Sundays. Now, I don't need to do all that. I do it because I love it. And I also think it's beneficial to the startup, right? Like in terms of keeping my academic affiliation, my credibility as a clinical professor helps Maximus. And that's why I've always done it. And then the same thing, keeping my license active, like when I'm doing these shows and advice, like I'm a licensed psychologist that actively sees clients. So I still keep very sharp and up to date. I know what I'm talking about, right? And I can speak from direct experience, also beneficial to the company. But I don't have any illusions. I don't think you can. I don't like 50-50, by the way. I don't like people who are like, you know, or like have a full-time job and a 20-hour week job on top of it. I really think if you're going to do side hustles, it should be like 80-20 or 90-10 is the rule of thumb that I like to say, in that you really should have one major, you know, cash or equity generating kind of thing. And the other things that you do, they should really be supplementary or complementary, right? Like for me, I'm like an hour extra a week to teach. It's something I've been doing for 8 years. It takes no prep at this work. It is just beneficial to me and to students. There's not a lot of cost or downside, right? And it gives me like unique sort of benefits that makes the cost benefit worthwhile. Now, there are unfortunately other adjunct folks that I know. They piece together like four different adjunct teaching positions. They literally are driving around the city teaching at four different universities because they only get paid like 25 grand per teaching gig. So they have to teach at four different places to make a meager living. It's not even 100 grand. They're probably making, I don't know, 10,000 per teaching gig. Four teaching gigs, they're making 40, 50 grand a year, right? And they're doing it with a lot more stress than someone who just has a stable 9-to-5 job making 40, 50K a year, right? Can you imagine working four jobs to make 40 grand versus just like one job to make 40 grand? To me, that's a stupid side hustle, right? And I see this a lot with people who are trying to be creatives or influencers. They're like hustling, putting together four or five different jobs in order to make the dream work. If you're, which I don't believe in. I don't believe in following your passion. I think less than 5% of people should follow their passion. And the few people that do should have an objective third party telling them that they're more talented than other people. If you want to be a singer, you better have people who are like, you're a damn good singer. And it's not just your mom and your friends, right? You should have a ridiculous work ethic, right? That you're gonna outwork everyone in order to succeed. You should really be realistic about sort of that path. So I don't believe in cobbling together a whole bunch of different things. I do think for most people having one main thing, and then you can go do your passion on the side, do it as a hobby, do it as a freelancer, go make a little extra money if you want, or to just do fulfill your heart or your creative spirit to go volunteer and to serve other people. Those are great side hustles because maybe what you get from your primary job is money and stability and feeding your family. That's great. That's noble. And maybe you do other things for, like I said, other values, right? And it fulfills those other needs, then you should do side hustles for those reasons. But kind of piecing together a whole bunch of things in order to make the stability and financial thing work, in my general opinion, is not a very good model. Thanks to everyone who called in today on Maximus Call and Radio Show 32. We had a lot of great questions today. And if you have any questions for future radio shows, please DM me or Victor, and we'll make sure we get to it next week, Thursday at 6 o'clock. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful week.